Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on this on the slow, that would be the show.
And only an hour to go, kid.
I know. But no, it kind of makes, that little snafu makes a little sense. Slow food bluegrass.
It does, yeah. Yeah, Mark Williams, he's a chef at Brown Foreman, which is a great job. But he really has a wonderful, he's appeared at Hidden Hill. We had a jazz thing this summer. He's going to be again September 6th at a bluegrass festival we're going to have. But way beyond that, he just has a great meal, organically grown stuff, locally grown stuff, produced stuff, fabulous food. And there's a whole movement, statewide, nationwide, international-wide. They call it slow food.
Slow food.
You know, to kind of throw it in the face of the fast food franchises. Right. But he's an interesting guy and does a great job.
Yeah, and he's sort of the convivium leader here in the bluegrass. Mark is for the slow food movement, and they call it slow food bluegrass here. But yeah, all states started in Italy. We actually interviewed several years back the international component to slow food. But you know, it's you know, making country ham the old fashioned way, for example, or making bread the old fashioned way is part of it. But also just the joy of eating food with other people. You know, so it goes beyond just the food component, but also the way that you enjoy the food. So we'll talk to Mark and find out what's going on around town with slow food. And then David Wilcove is going to join us. He's the author of a book called No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations. It's a really fabulous book. Really good information, you know, whether it's a migratory birds, buffalo, the wildebeest in the Serengeti, just how the world's greatest, you know, migrations have been impacted by human activity, basically.
Yeah, it's a fabulous book, well-written, and ultimately a little depressing because of the results it gives us that all the great migrations are impacted now. The monarchs, the sea turtles, the salmon, the birds, everything are impacted primarily because of changes in the climate. And again, I keep going back to symbiotic relationships, which
I
love to talk about. But the birds will take off, or the dragonflies will take off, assuming there's some food along the way, because there always has been. But because of maybe a change in climate or
the
seasons are different.
Your fuel stop doesn't have the fuel because it's too early in the season.
The caterpillars aren't there for the particular birds, or maybe the milkweed's not blooming when the monarchs are going south and coming back north.
Yeah.
And it's all interrelated, and we just keep forgetting that.
Yeah. It's, what did they say? And I'll get it all wrong, Bob, but if you sneeze in one place, does it, or like a butterfly's wings beat in the in Central America, and that creates a chain reaction, a domino effect. Well, so many of the things that humans do are kind of
absolutely
creating a negative domino effect.
And this just documents it very clearly and honestly and accurately. Yeah. And he'll be great to listen to.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward
to least
talking
just to make the world more aware of what we got to stop doing this stuff.
Yeah. So that's coming up. We hope that you'll stay with us today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Actually, it's been kind of fun. I mentioned earlier in the year, I think, that I was worried about my vines. I couldn't find an annual vine I liked. I've settled on the cup and saucer vine. It's just been fabulous.
Yeah.
It's a neat vine. It grows really quick. In fact, it's already climbed past the arbor. It's into the trees and should be in Sellersburg in about about 2 weeks. But it's got this beautiful purple bell with kind of like a white dingers in it. It's just a great vine, and it's climbing up the trees, and I'm just really happy with it, and I'm glad I did it.
And it's an annual vine, huh?
Yeah, annual vine. I don't know how if it's going to reseed everywhere for the next 27 years, which can happen with those things, but cup and saucer looks good to me. The other thing is I had an experiment I mentioned a while back of putting white caladiums in a red pot. It's almost poetic and simple and easy. It's really worked well. I go out in the shade now, and I look at it, and here's a red pot.
It's a good way to brighten up the shade, huh?
Yep, and it's effective. I love that look, too. So I'm really happy those two things have worked.
Great.
Summer stuff.
Yeah.
How about the wishes?
I got summer stuff, too.
Going to
talk tomatoes. I always pay very close attention to the tomatoes that I grow every year in terms of taste and like what I like, you know, take notes.
Because I usually write. Actually.
Yeah, yeah, because you get them.
Right.
But, you know, I usually write a column about it and, you know, let people know what I think. You know, everybody's got different tastes, of course. But traditionally, and it still is one of my favorites, but I didn't grow it this year for no fault of my own, but the Cherokee Purple is a great tomato. But this year, I think my favorite tomato is Arkansas Traveler.
Why, pray tell?
And that's what's, I know you've got one in your little goodie bag from today. It's a very tasty tomato. I mean, it's got to taste good, period, the end. So we've established that. But it's almost store-bought looking because they hold up really well. Like, it's firm, but it, like, you almost think it won't taste good.
Because
it's not, like, messed up.
Yeah, nothing that good looking can possibly be that interesting.
It's got a nice color to it. It's pretty firm, so it holds up well. I'm surprised that you don't see it more often in retail markets, just because it seems like a pretty durable, darn tasty tomato.
Might be too folksy.
I don't know.
I'm not going to buy an Arkansas Traveler.
I don't know. But I'm telling you, people, if you're looking for some interesting ones to grow next year, consider Arkansas Traveler.
Does it play the fiddle?
I bet you could teach it to play the fiddle. Okay. It looks smart enough.
Fair enough.
All right. Talking about food, homegrown food, and heirloom tomatoes, I'm sure Mark Williams is mighty familiar with all of that.
Yeah, Mark's our first guest. He knows about tomatoes and a lot of other things. A very interesting man with a really interesting life. He's now executive chef at Brown-Forman. But he got into the chef business the natural way. His family history has a real Southern flavor to it. He lived in Texas, Georgia, Florida, and Tennessee while his dad was in the service. One grandfather had a cattle farm in North Carolina, and his great-great-grandmother ran a cafe in Memphis. Along the way, he opened an Italian deli in Atlanta, was a music industry agent, became a chef in a small restaurant in Georgia, and parlayed it all into what's now called slow food bluegrass here in Kentucky. Mark, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here on the number one show on public radio with the two of you, the click and clack of the gardening world.
Boy, some corn already.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, you didn't think this was going to be a dry interview with the chef from Brown-Forman.
Yeah, no kidding.
And speaking of that, and the introduction was interesting. You had a really interesting life with a strong Southern flavor to it and family involved in restaurants and the cattle business and so forth. Kind of bring us up through that to when you arrived in Louisville with the Brown-Forman gig that you got here.
Well, I came here through Brown-Forman, through the Woodford Reserve Distillery. I was doing catering in Lexington. Mm-hmm. I actually had moved to California, to Kentucky, to enjoy a better quality of life and to return to those Southern roots that I miss. I mean, if you ever move away from the South, you'll probably find that it's in you and drawing you back.
Mm-hmm. I mean, really, do you think that sort of romantic Southern food experience has left its mark on you in a way that, you know, other chefs don't really experience food in the same sort of way, you know, and obviously for our purposes today, your involvement in slow food bluegrass.
Well, it was, that's true. It's totally subliminal. I grew up, my great-grandmother had a cafe in Memphis and ran it during the Depression, used to give food away to people who, when they didn't have money to eat. So that was really something that was instilled in me, that value of helping people and the underdogs.
Food,
but I always would eat that food when we were in Memphis. My dad was in the Army, so we traveled to every 2 years, moved, and none of that food was local. So when I started doing my chef's training, I started getting turned on to European foods and Asian foods, and I thought, you know, how wonderful this is and all of the exotic things. But I've really come around full circle to appreciate the good Southern food and the local food that I grew up on.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk some about the Brown-Forman culture, too, which to me could be a role model for a lot of industries and businesses who are kind of going the other way, frankly. What people can find there in the way of food and in growing their own vegetables on-site at a local business?
Well, we have two gardens there on Brown-Forman property in the west end of Louisville. It's a definitely an industrial area, and we have a beautiful herb garden, and I grew some vegetables in it, but it's carved right in the center of the parking lot. And it wasn't very hospitable. It was bearberry bushes, and Lois Matus, who is at Brown-Forman at the time, said I could have a portion of the garden, but I had to leave the ginkgo tree alone.
So
I came over there one weekend and pulled all the bushes out with my with the bumper and a chain.
Redneck way.
Yes.
A true Southern boy.
And went to planting heirloom seeds and vegetables, and got every year I would just add to my collection, and now it's a group of volunteer plants mainly that come back and
the value of heirlooms too, because they come back true from seed.
And they're my friends.
I'm sorry. What can a Brown-Forman employee expect for lunch under your kind hands?
Yeah, because do you use in the kitchen there the stuff that you're growing in that garden?
We do. We have a new garden, which is 160 half-size Jack Daniel's barrels that we got from the distillery.
Sure.
And I made a false bottom from a ground cherry tree that was historical on the property as uh-huh. well. And then we have, of course, organic soil and compost in there, and mm-hmm. we're growing heirloom varieties there. And that's going to be more the food producing, but we've always had a very interesting variety of herbs mm-hmm. that we serve in the cafe from our herb garden.
Mm-hmm. And Bob, here, take a bite yeah. of this. Looks
oh
like
my
fried green tomatoes.
He brought in some fried green tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes.
They grew there some basil, some beautiful basil.
Oh boy.
Peppers and some tomatoes.
Pardon me, Louisville, I'm eating lunch.
So, yes, this is what slow food is all about, and that's what we're going to talk about today as well. Slow Food Bluegrass is, you're the Convivium leader?
Yes.
Okay. But it's a movement that's across the country and, in fact, international. Can you give our listeners an idea of what the slow food movement is all about and how far-reaching it is?
Well, it actually started in Italy in 1986 by Carlo Petrini and a group of his friends. He is a publisher in Italy and a movie producer as well, mm-hmm. and grew up in a very small little town there in northern Italy outside of Turin. And he and his friends would gather around, and they'd have traditional foods, great meals, and great conversations. And something that would come up in the conversation was how their pace of life was speeding up too much, and the quality of life was going down too fast as well. Mm-hmm. And they kind of decided that they'd do whatever they could to preserve their traditional food ways and the local farmers and local producers. And it's just an idea that has spread around the world, that everybody in every country can really understand that concept, and they see it in their society too. Mm-hmm. And they became really famous for taking bowls of macaroni and throwing it at the McDonald's people when they tried to open a shop at the foot of the Spanish Steps. So, so it's kind of the three legs.
That's good publicity, yeah. huh? That'll get it out in the news for sure.
Yeah, but it's conversation mm-hmm. and action uh-huh. that are kind of the basis of the slow food movement.
Yeah, and clearly something that people were ripe to receive in terms of slowing down and enjoying food and experiencing these things a little bit differently and making sure that some of these traditions aren't lost.
That's right. I mean, in such a short amount of time, we've done so much damage to the planet and have put so many plant varieties and species on the edge of extinction, like the bourbon red turkeys. They were down to, I think, 50 pairs of bourbon red turkeys in this country, and that's a breed that was developed here in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And it was the most common turkey at Thanksgiving time on the American table until the 1950s when the broad-breasted, quick-growing commercial right. variety came along. And now Slow Food and other groups have saved the bourbon red turkey from extinction, and they're plentiful now. And that's just an example of a local example of something that's happened.
Well, Mark, we mentioned earlier, we had you out at Hidden Hill. We're going to have you again here on September 6th. But tell me about the menu you typically serve with a meal like that, and take people through what it was and how you put it together.
Well, we really love it. Of course, Bob has this fantastic outdoor kitchen at the Hidden Hills. I don't know if he knows. I think it's a potting shed, actually. but when we're there, it's a great kitchen, yeah. It's our favorite kind of meal to do, really. It's part of our Chefs of Field program with Slow Food Bluegrass. Mm-hmm. And I typically like to go to the farmer's market and talk to the farmers and say, what's really fresh today? What do you recommend? And they give me the really good stuff for Bob's events. And
so you never know exactly what you're going to be working with or what you're going to get.
I don't, mm-hmm. not too far in advance. Of course, it's the buffalo and bluegrass event. So we use the Kentucky bison mm-hmm. buffalo, and we use the local. We're just showing that everything can be local, that mm-hmm. you can have a really nice meal and using all local products and everything in season. And it's very quickly prepared. I mean, it's not a lot of time involved in the meal. It's just trying to show in our support for the local farmers as well.
Mm-hmm. But you'll have 40 or 50 events throughout the summer, at least it seems like.
It seems like that, yeah. I have a hard time saying no, but there are a lot of groups that are just really good partners with us, like the Sierra Club and Shaker Village, Locust Grove, and the Black Acre Conservancy. Mm-hmm. They're just a nice fit for other nonprofit groups, and everybody has to eat. So when they go to look for food for their events, they tend to come to me and say, Would you like to partner with us? And sure.
And it is a nonprofit group, we should say that.
We are a total nonprofit group. And right. It's all volunteers. We no one is paid, and we couldn't do it without our volunteers.
Mm-hmm. So, Mark, how do people respond to the food that you're preparing? Do you know what I mean? Is it a hard sell for some people? Like, you know, what is that? And bison, ew. Or...
Yeah, that we have very few non-takers. Everybody yeah. everybody really wants to try it. And and I'd like to say that we're converting people into farmers market and local producers, shoppers. So
yeah, good.
Nothing but favorable reviews so far.
And that's the whole point, I guess. In terms of slow food bluegrass, are there other, I mean, you had mentioned the turkey kind of rehabilitation of the population. Are there other things that you guys are sort of focusing on locally that need equal attention, that you're fearful of techniques or species or varieties or knowledge of being lost?
Well, the whole idea of this RAFT project, the Renewing America's Food Tradition, it's mm-hmm. it's kind of like, you know, there's the Ark of Taste, and that was started by Slow Food International, so it's the Ark. So you get the endangered items together so that they're protected, okay. like Noah's Ark. So America has the RAFT. So I'm really pushing to get single source Kentucky bourbon and slow aged Kentucky hams on the RAFT. So I think that'll be a much better boat to be on.
No kidding, I want to be on that boat. That's for sure.
But one thing that that we're interested in doing and preserving is the farmers and the traditions of farming mm-hmm. that are kind of endangered right now. Kentucky has 86,000 tax-paying farms, and that's huge. It's a huge number, but a lot of them are converting over to a single crop, and that single crop, such as corn, mm-hmm. soybeans, is not always going for food. So
right.
There's actually a project in eastern Kentucky with the Pine Mountain Settlement School that we'd like to focus on and kind of take that property and teach the people who work there how to farm the old-fashioned way and how to cook the old-fashioned way as well.
Well, Mark, is the slow food bluegrass picking up speed, so to speak, from when you started 7 years ago?
I think so. We've been really fortunate here because we've had Erica Lesser, the president of Slow Food USA, was a keynote speaker at the Growing Kentucky Conference mm-hmm. 2 years ago. Whereas we had Alice Waters as a keynote speaker at the Sierra Club Conference, and she's the vice president of Slow Food International. Barbara Kingsolver, who is a...
Right.
You spent much time in Kentucky, yeah. And she did a lot in her last book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, mm-hmm. to promote slow food. So there's been a lot of interest growing, but it just generally all over the world, it's really grown.
In fact, I see Turin, Italy is on the schedule for the end of this year. Are you going to be part of that trip?
I am. There are 20 Excellent. Of us from Kentucky that have been selected by Slow Food USA to represent Kentucky mm-hmm. at the Terra Madre World Food Communities gathering, mm-hmm. and that's quite an honor. There's 700 people from the United States total, so
wow.
for 20 of us to be able to go, and we're all be guests of Slow Food. Mm-hmm. We just have to pay for our airfare, mm-hmm. so that's a week of conferences and eating and conversation. It's just going to be really fantastic. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there's the world's largest artisanal food show going on in mm-hmm. the former Fiat factory. There's And there's 35,000 people a day, uh-huh. and you should see the food. It's unbelievable. I got to go 2 years ago.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thanks for coming in. We sure appreciate it. I'm looking forward to tasting your food.
Well, yes. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Mark.
Mark Williams is executive chef at Brown-Forman and the leader in the slow food bluegrass movement here in Kentuckiana. For more information on Mark or how to get on his party schedule, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, David Wilcove and the decline of the world's great animal migrations. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill. And Ms. Wishy, as we migrate down the dial here...
Yeah.
We have a really great guest coming up.
Yeah, we do. And, I think so many of us, we know about some of the migratory issues with some of the migratory birds, the monarch butterfly, but it goes much deeper than that.
And we don't put it in context.
Yeah, we don't.
We observe these things happening in the fall and in the spring, and we say, geez, spring's here, summer's here.
But it's the devil's in the details.
Yeah,
isn't it?
But the whole global movement is something we don't think about.
Yeah, so this will give you something to think about for sure. David Wilcove is joining us now. He's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Princeton University. His research focus is on the conservation of biodiversity and the development of innovative approaches to protect endangered species, migratory species, and wilderness. He's also the author of several books, including No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations. David, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. It's our pleasure as well. Listen, let's first sort of discuss the true definition of migration and then some of the classic reasons to do so.
Sure. Migration refers to an animal that goes from one place to another for a portion of the year and then returns.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's a round-trip journey, as opposed to just dispersing to a new place to live the rest of its life.
Okay. What are the underlying traits of the action? Why bother?
I think the main reason animals migrate is opportunism. That is to say, they're going to places where they can get something important, usually food, but only for a part of the year. And they have to leave that area when the seasons change or the food resource disappears.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, birds will migrate to the northern forests of the United States and Canada to spend the summer because there are all sorts of insects there. It's a great place to raise a family if you're an insect-eating bird. But you got to get out before the cold weather comes mm-hmm. and the insects disappear.
Yeah.
You know, David, it just occurred to me that humans did the same thing for a long time before they figured out how to grow their own stuff.
That's right. We had tribes of Native Americans that followed the bison herds. That was sort of a human migration following an animal migration. And even today, not so much out of necessity, but there are certainly people who will spend their summer in the north and then move to the south for the winter and return again.
Yeah. Well, and that kind of begs the next question that I have, you know, some more examples of what triggers the action. Okay, food for one, and the disappearance of food in one area, cold temperatures for another, whether you're heading south to Florida as a human or as a bird, right? Are there other things that trigger, you know, just some sort of physiological response in a species to start moving?
Well, we have to distinguish between the ultimate reason, which is usually something like the loss of food,
mm-hmm.
And what we might call the proximate response, the immediate trigger. So, for example, many birds probably use changes in day length as the cue that it's time to go north or south.
Like plants do.
That's right. And like people, birds have multiple navigation systems. In the same way that your plane has backup navigation systems, so do birds.
Uh-huh. But real, like, still, how do they know where to go? Do you know what I mean?
It's a great mystery. And there's a lot of research that's going on now to try to unravel that. We think in some cases they have what we could refer to as a genetic map. That is, it's encoded in their genes. And they navigate by reading the Earth's magnetic field or, in some cases, by looking at the apparent motion of the stars in the skies, just like sailors have done for hundreds of years. In other cases, they may be using landmarks, mountain ranges, valleys, coastlines, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And probably most of these species have a couple of methods that they use under different conditions. So a bird wouldn't want to rely solely on the motion of the stars, because on a cloudy night, that would be useless.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, and we'll get more detail later, like the monarch butterfly or the dragonflies, it's succeeding generations to get to the final destination. This is encoded in their tiny little brains, and the great-great-grandkids are the ones that get back from where the great-great-grandma started.
I think in many respects, that is the most baffling migration, the monarch butterfly. Because what happens with the monarchs is the butterflies that have spent the winter in those forests in Mexico begin heading north in February or March. They get to the southeastern United States. They lay eggs and they die. Those eggs turn into monarchs. Those monarchs continue the northward journey laying eggs and dying, and their grandchildren continue the journey. And it's really maybe four or five generations later before that last group of monarchs born in the summer turn around and head south and go back to the very same mountain mm-hmm. where their great-great-grandparents spent the winter.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing now in much of the eastern United States. Those monarchs that are lazily floating by are going to a place that their great-great-grandparents last visited.
Wow.
And how they're able to do that, how they're able to, in essence, reverse course after several generations and get back to that same place, remains a mystery.
Yeah, and your book details some depressing detail, actually, that there's four prime reasons why in land, sea, and air, all the migrations are being hindered these days. Touch on those four reasons for us.
That's right. The main threats to animal migration include the destruction of habitats, the creation of obstacles and barriers. So, for example, a fence that can block off the migratory route of bison or elk. Over-exploitation, because many migratory species gather in large herds, schools, or flocks. They're easy for people to harvest and to over-harvest. And then lastly, global climate change, which could really disrupt the patterns and timing of migration.
So let's take a look at some of the examples in each of those. Bob and I were talking earlier, David, about just the amazing symbiotic relationship that exists in each ecosystem. And, you know, based on those threats, these ecosystems are becoming more and more fragile. So you take out one part and the domino effect of everything else collapsing, you know, is essentially what's happening. So migratory birds, let's start there.
And would you like me to talk a little bit about an example, say, of how these factors can harm a migration?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know,
sure.
the Swainson's thrush, for example, or the red knot.
Okay. The red knot is a sandpiper. It nests in the Canadian Arctic, and it winters in Tierra del Fuego. So it has one of the longest migrations of any animal. Now, when the red knots are migrating north in the spring, for a very brief period of time, all of them funnel into Delaware Bay. And there, they feed on the eggs of a horseshoe crab.
Mm-hmm.
The horseshoe crabs themselves are migrating from the ocean into the bay, and they're laying their eggs, and those eggs provide a really important food resource for the red knot, because the knots basically have to store up enough energy in the form of fat to make the last leg of their migration, which is from Delaware Bay all the way to the tundra
mm-hmm.
in Canada.
Wow.
And what has happened is that the red knots are crashing in numbers, probably because the horseshoe crabs are being overfished. There are a small group of people who fish the horseshoe crabs and basically sell them as bait to catch still other types of seafood.
Mm-hmm.
And because of their overfishing, there is less food for the red knots during this critical period of time when they need to put on this weight, to have the fat, the energy, to make their migration back to the Arctic. And so you see this wonderful system that has evolved over thousands of years collapsing because the horseshoe crabs are being reduced in numbers. It's a real tragedy, and I hope that we can stop the fishery long enough for the horseshoe crab numbers to rebound
mm-hmm.
so that the red knot and, in fact, many other species of shorebirds are able to continue their migration.
So that necessary pit stop, basically, for them to refuel has been removed.
It's been much diminished.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
Yeah, to jump a continent, now you also were tracking in the Serengeti Plain, which you all sort of know about in a romantic sort of way, and the wildebeest is having problems in there, too.
The wildebeest migration in the Serengeti is probably the most spectacular mammal migration left on Earth. And fortunately, quite a few years ago, the governments of Kenya and Tanzania created a joint system of nature reserves that more or less protects the habitat of the wildebeest. And for that reason, this migration has endured. But the thing that drives the migration, the thing that sustains these animals, is the grass. And the grass depends on the rains. And it's certainly possible that with global climate change, you will see less and less precipitation in that part of East Africa. And if that happens, then we could see a tremendous reduction in the number of wildebeest and the loss of this incredible wildlife spectacle.
And it's not just the wildebeest, because sort of the whole point of what you were researching while you were there was sort of the whole concept of grazing succession and the importance of the wildebeest's presence, and then the gazelles and the zebras and all of that. So can you talk a little bit about how that you know, it, I mean, essentially the answering the question of why did the wildebeest migrate after all, and then what's the ripple effect from that migration?
That's right. There are a number of species that are basically linked together. So in the case of the Serengeti, the zebra tend to migrate first, and they're able to eat the very coarse, dead grass that is present. In eating that dead grass, though, they basically create space, openings for the younger grass to regenerate, and that's what draws in the wildebeest. And then after the wildebeest, the Thompson's gazelles. Mm-hmm. So really, what happens is that each of the species more or less paves the way for the next one. Mm-hmm. And the three together are able to use the food resources of the Serengeti in a way that's more advantageous to each species than if it was just the one species.
Mm-hmm. So if the migration is disrupted, what happens?
It's a good question. I think what we would see would be declines, of course, in the three principal grazers, mm-hmm. but also declines in a number of other species. There are, for example, a variety of birds that come into the areas that have been recently grazed. They like those sort of short, lawn-like landscapes that the grazers create. And, of course, one of the big unknowns is how the nutrient cycles in the Serengeti would be disrupted if you didn't have all of these animals that are basically eating the grass, processing it, excreting the nutrients, mm-hmm. and helping to maintain that grassland ecosystem.
Huh. And there's probably an insect in there somewhere that's adding to the bird cycle, providing
food.
Oh,
there are a lot of insects. The insects, I suspect, consume as much or more forage than the mammals do. Mm-hmm. But they have been studied less intensively than the big mammal.
Mm-hmm. Right. How about the American bison, the buffalo? That's a story we all know a little bit about, but apparently not enough.
It's a fascinating story because in its heyday, if we went back a couple hundred years, that was probably the largest aggregation of big mammals on the face of the earth.
How many would there be in a herd then?
There are reports of herds exceeding 1 million individuals. But certainly there were herds that could be numbered in the hundreds of thousands. Mm-hmm. And the total number of bison that were on the Great Plains has been variously estimated as anywhere from about 10 million to 60 million or more. Mm-hmm. So it was a spectacular collection of large mammals. And, of course, in a very short period of time, really just a matter of a few decades, it was completely obliterated by the white settlers as they moved through that area.
So tell us some of the methods and reasons behind the obliteration of the bison on the plains in such a short period of time. I mean, literally like a couple of decades.
That's right. There were a number of factors going on there. There was an element of sheer racism in the sense that the federal government at that time wanted to gain control of the land. There were a number of Native American tribes that depended on the bison, and the thought was if they eliminated the bison, that would force those tribes onto the reservation land. Mm-hmm. So it was in part an effort to control the Native American. The second thing was that there was a lot of hunting for sport, and there was then a big industry that was oriented around the pelts of the bison, which were called bison robes. They really wanted that fur. And then that, in turn, was replaced by an even greater demand for the leather of the bison, which was used to make belts, not the sorts of belts one wears, but industrial belts for machinery. Because they discovered that they could make a belt out of bison leather that was as good and cheaper than the belts that they were making out of cow leather. And so that led to an industrial scale slaughter of the bison to get the leather for the Industrial Revolution in the United States. And ultimately, it resulted in the near extinction of the bison.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the opening paragraph of your book, this is not just North America. This is a whole worldwide phenomena of different migratory patterns being interrupted by man, you know, just across the globe.
Yes, that's correct. Because the things that are harmful to migrating animals in the United States, loss of habitat, overexploitation, global climate change, things like that, they're happening around the world. Migratory animals are difficult to conserve because they don't stay in one place, and because they often travel in large herds or flocks. And so we see these same problems all over the world. It's really a global challenge trying to protect migrating animals.
I imagine China in particular now is a real problem with some animals like that.
Yes, there are a number of large mammals, antelope, and things like that in parts of China that are in trouble. With the damming of the rivers, some of the big fish migrations have declined or disappeared. So certainly the challenge of protecting animal migration is even greater in a country like China that is undergoing such rapid development.
Change, yeah. So let's talk about water. Give us an example of some things that are happening to aquatic life that need to migrate and they're being prevented.
A very good example from the United States would be in the Pacific Northwest, the great salmon migration that once occurred there. A half a dozen species of salmon and sea-growing trout. So, for example, during the era of Lewis and Clark, probably on the order of 11 to 16 million salmon went up the Columbia River every year. Today, that number is anywhere from about a half a million to a million, and virtually all of those salmon are the product of hatcheries rather than truly wild fish.
Wow.
And so what has happened there? Well, it's been the development of the Pacific Northwest, the big hydropower dams that were put in place during the Great Depression, the logging, which harmed some of the rivers. Overfishing has been an issue as well, and irrigation, the removal of water from the rivers for agricultural purposes. Really, the development of the Pacific Northwest has been very harmful to the great salmon migration.
So what are the consequences of not as many salmon migrating?
One of the interesting thing about salmon is that when they're very small fish, not that long after they hatch, they leave the rivers and they go out to the ocean, where they spend anywhere from 1 to 3 years, and they basically grow up and get big in the ocean.
Yeah.
And
wow,
they're able to do that because the ocean is such a productive place. They come back up those rivers to the place where they were born, those streams and rivers. They spawn, they die, they decay. What they're really doing is transporting nutrients from the ocean back to the rivers.
Back to the river.
And in that respect, they're very important for maintaining the health of the western rivers.
Well, David, when all's said and done, are you an optimist or a pessimist we're ever going to solve these problems?
I'm hopeful that we will certainly be able to protect some of the great migrations that remain. It's in our own best interest to do so. We need migrating birds to eat the insects that would otherwise be harmful to our forests and crops. We need migrating salmon as a food source for us and for other animals. And I think places like Kenya and Tanzania need the great mammals of the Serengeti to sustain the tourism industry that's so important to those countries. So we have a stake not only in preventing the extinction of migrants, but in keeping them common. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful that we will get better at working together. We'll learn to work across boundaries and jurisdictions, because those sorts of boundaries don't mean anything to the migratory animals, even if they mean a lot to us. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful that more people will recognize how important migration is to us economically, ecologically, and even aesthetically, and we will see greater efforts to save these animals.
David, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Uh-huh. David Wilkove is the author of No Way Home, The Decline of the World's Great Animal Migrations. He's also a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Princeton University, where he continues to focus his research on the conservation of biodiversity and developing innovative approaches to protect endangered and migratory species and wilderness.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill, I am.
And moving right along to not so much more uplifting details, but we do have some questions. This one's from Denise. She says, hi, I'm hoping that you can help me with my tree. It's an approximately 40-year-old water maple, which is kind of sad news already. At least that's what I was told. In the last 10 years, it's been topped out twice.
Ouch.
Which is bad.
Yes.
It now seems to have a problem with the bark falling away from the trunk on the west side of the tree.
Among other things.
There are little holes in the trunk that look like something has burrowed its way in.
Probably has.
And the leaves are showing brown spots. Unfortunately, Denise did actually attach some photos, so Bob and I got a good look at the tree. Because her question is, am I losing the tree? And Bob shouted out,
yes.
Yes. Has something infested it? If it is, can we identify what? Because she's wondering if it's termites, and it's not. And is there anything she can do to help it?
Yeah, you can buy a chainsaw or find somebody with a chainsaw. They're not great trees to begin with. They only get worse with age, like 40 years. They're eventually going to fall down. Although I have seen, have one in my yard, one that's pretty darn healthy. But by and large, they're fast-growing, quote, junk trees, unquote, mm-hmm.
And the fact that it's been topped
twice.
That's bad.
And I saw it, and she shot a picture of it. So,
Literally, like, bark is, whole chunks of bark are falling off the tree, which is a really bad sign.
If she can, just bite the bullet and cut it down and start over. If it's out away from the house, it won't hurt anything. But it's only going to get worse.
Yeah.
There's no hope.
Yeah. I'd have it taken down as well.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, it's also, you know, good selection is important, certainly now that you have the opportunity to select and put something else new. And people just simply should not top trees.
No.
Don't top trees. Not that that's totally the fault of, or, you know, the cause of the decline, but it certainly isn't going to help.
And so, don't buy water maples.
Don't buy water maples. All right, this next question, Bob, is from Sue. She said, this may sound strange, but each year around the 1st of August, my dog starts to have allergic reactions for about a week or two.
Yeah.
Really bad coughing, sneezing, general itching. After a couple of weeks, it seems to slow down. And she is starting to notice some symptoms of this allergy attack, Bob. And she's wondering if there's something that's, in general, blooming or going on in the area that might contribute to her dog's sneezing and sniffling.
Yeah, well, it's late summer, and ragweed abounds, and other allergies are going to abound. And I'm sure that it can affect dogs, too. They're mammals like we are.
We're certainly not experts on this.
No.
I would definitely take your dog to the veterinarian. But ragweed is the thing that has popped to our mind as being one thing to consider, because that's what people are allergic to the most this time of the year as well.
Yeah, and animals must be too.
Yeah.
So
there.
Check it out.
Check with your vet and maybe take a specimen of ragweed and see if that actually has extra irritating effect on your dog. All right. If you have a question.
Yeah, something with a little more upper, upper tend to it.
Yeah.
If you have a happy, ebullient go get 'em question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 814-8246.
right, Bob, it's a Plant Story Week. What do you have for us?
Plum bagel.
Sounds
like dessert.
It does, actually.
There's just not enough blue in the plant world, mm-hmm. particularly the plumbago blue that I just love it.
It's beautiful. It's like a periwinkle blue.
Yeah, and there's the California poppy and there's others like this. There should be more. I don't know what God had in mind when he held off on the blue in
that
gardens.
That true blue.
But he did. And really, there's two different kinds. The first, the more popular around here, of course, is not really a true plumbago, but it is cold hardy. It's also called leadwort. I'll mm-hmm. get to more of that later. Why call a beautiful plant leadwort's beyond me. But it's this wiry, kind of mat-forming perennial, late summer bloomer with those beautiful mm-hmm. blue flowers. And then the foliage is a shiny green and turns off kind of red bronze in the fall. I just love the thing.
It's a great plant.
Yeah, nice ground cover. It's called leadwort because there's about 10 or 20 different cultivars of this thing. Most of them southern hemisphere had lead blue colors. A few of them did.
Oh, that's why.
That's why. The other reason is, this is a late theory, that people ate it to avoid lead poisoning.
Huh.
You can only hope they were right.
Yeah, so this is the hardy plumbago, yeah. Cerastigma plumbaganoides.
Exactly, Cerastigma plumbaganoides.
I love that plant.
Thank God you said that for me first. Yeah. Cerastigma comes from the Greek charis for horn and stigma, as in the flower part. Mm-hmm. The stigma is horn-like.
Mm-hmm.
Plumbaganoides comes from the Latin word for lead, which is plumbum.
Mm-hmm.
And the anoides sounds like,
right.
or looks like.
Yeah.
So there you are. It's plum bum is lead. What a dumb word for lead. There's also a Cape plumbago. That's
so where
the one.
Plumbing comes from?
Good. Yeah. Hmm. I bet it does.
Maybe. Anyway, go ahead, sir.
Because it was lead plumbing to start with.
I guess.
I'll be darned. The Cape plumbago is the one that's not hardy here at all, but it's a beautiful light blue flower also. You see it in the southern climates. I've saw it in Costa Rica. It's just like a big shrub.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful blue thing. It's an annual here. I take mine indoors, and I preserve it and put it out again the next year.
Mm-hmm.
The Latin for that one is plumbago auriculata.
Okay.
Auriculata means ear-shaped.
Okay.
As an oral.
Uh-huh.
To hear.
Sure.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. Now, so that's the true plumbago.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then there's one of the great writers in the history of gardening is a man called Henry Mitchell. He wrote about this plant in a book he had, and I'm just going to read some of this because I can't possibly improve on this guy. This is what he says about the plumbago. When it is in bloom, seething with cobalt and smartly attacking the eye with its brilliance, not even gentian surpass it in color. And in addition to that, it has assorted merits so great that any one of them entitles it to attention.
Mm-hmm.
All summer it sits there, biding its time and going from strength to strength in a controlled, sturdy way. It is not one of those things that is raced 5 feet off from where you planted it. No, it spreads reasonably, but knows nothing about how to become a weed.
Wow.
Then in July or August, an occasional nickel-sized flower will appear at the tip of the shoot, and these burst forth with increasing energy in September and continue slowing down a bit until late October.
Hmm.
After the flowers are all gone, the reddish bracts remain for a bit, and the foliage of the plant itself often, almost always, turns to a rich bronze and red. So even when the fall turns cold, the plant is handsome in its modest way, which is the best way for anything to be handsome.
No kidding. So Cerastigma plumbaganoides.
I know it's tough to top that with a poem, but I'm going to just do it quickly.
All right.
Oh me, oh my, what's the gardener to do when seeking out some heavenly blue? In landscape far, a rockery so near, yet there's no need to shed a tear. Just cast dry eye on the hardy plumbago, star performer in the late summer show. The perfect plant for the late summer breeze, even if you can't say plumbaganoides.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people can't say plumbaganoides.
But they can grow it.
But they can grow it. It's so easy to grow, and you have inspired me to plant more.
You
Thank
go, girl.
You.
Yes, ma'am.
It is a fabulous plant.
Yeah.
All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Bob and I are going to learn how to band hummingbirds with Brainerd Palmer Ball. That's hard to say, too. But I don't think we'll actually be allowed to do it, Bob. We'll just be able to observe.
Homegrown is produced by the rarely blue Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.